science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Welcome back, Alan.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Despite
in the cold?
Weather. Yeah, I know.
30 degrees yes, where you were.
30 degrees every day in Europe, yes, for the last 3 weeks. It's been lovely. Yeah,
it's pretty nice.
Yes, I know. But I was working. I had to see my colleagues in Grenoble and in Bordeaux, so, you know.
We survived without you.
I know. I was
and
listening
Marcus
to the podcast
very
over
well.
And he certainly did, yes.
I think he actually quite liked the seat.
I was scared I wouldn't have a seat this week, so yeah. Yes.
He may be back, though.
He may well be back, yes. Yeah, I think we might come to some arrangement here. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, that's good. Yeah. Nice to hear different voices.
Yep.
But first, we are starting with quite a sad story.
Oh, very
much
so, yeah. Yeah, this is a real sad story. And I guess I'm sort of bringing it up because something happened about it, I guess, this week. But also, it sort of does raise some very important questions as to, I guess, responsibility and stuff like that. So, as a background, so tragically, 10 years ago, a student at UCLA in the chemistry department at one of the UCLA campuses was killed because she was using a very pyrophoric material in the lab. Pyrophoric, for those of you who don't know, means that it catches fire spontaneously on exposure to air, which means
it is dangerous.
Now, again, chemists use this sort of stuff all the time. So you need very, very specialised techniques to use it. Obviously, you can't just sort of have a bottle of it and take the lid off because air gets in and it'll just burst into flame. So you need to use special syringes and special conditions where you don't have any air around. Now, she was an undergraduate student, a third-year student, who was doing some research in the lab, as undergrad students often do in the laboratory. Opinions differ about exactly what happened or didn't happen or whatever, but basically she was using this very, very nasty material that I really wouldn't want to touch with a barge pole. Mm-hmm. She was trying to syringe it out of the bottle. The plunger apparently came out of the end of the syringe and the whole stuff burst into flame. She wasn't wearing a lab coat. She got very, very badly burnt in this, and she died 18 days later in hospital. So a really, really tragic situation. Mm. As a result of this, both her supervisor, a guy by the name of Professor Patrick Hannon, and the university were taken to court. So 3 years later, in 2011, they were charged with felony labor code violations. So they were they said that they weren't providing them a safe workplace, they didn't provide them safety clothes, and they didn't provide them safety training. The university in 2012 came to a plea deal, essentially, where they said that they would give a scholarship in her memory. I think sort of $500,000, something like that. And then the professor in 2014 again settled, and the basis of the settlement was that he would pay a $10,000 fine and he'd do some community service. And if he agreed to a set of conditions, after 5 years all the charges will be dropped, and so that 5 years is essentially up. In fact, it was sort of 4 and a bit years or whatever, but he's complied with those conditions.
Right, so that's where we're at now.
And so that's where we're at now. Mm. And, you know, this does raise obvious questions. So the chemistry lab in particular is a potentially very dangerous place to be in if you're not well trained. So every student that I put into a chemistry lab, I make sure that they know what the hell they're doing. I go in with them, I train them, I tell them what's nasty, I tell them what's not nasty.
Surely that's what everybody should be doing.
And that's what everyone should be doing. And the question then becomes, what happened in this case? You know, was the student made fully aware of the potential dangers? Whose fault was it that she wasn't wearing a lab coat? Because that could well have saved her life. Because apparently the clothing she was wearing was very, very flammable. And that was very much part of the problem. There were some apparent problems in the lab. They had a lot of solvent sort of sitting around in the fume hood where she was doing this experiment. And so I believe...
Which also caught fire.
And, you know, just sort of contributed to the whole thing. So
a number of factors.
Indeed.
Really.
And this whole health and safety environment, the one thing that the high ups seem to want to do is apportion blame. That, to me, dare I say it, and I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but I think a lot of the health and safety sort of code and stuff is a matter of butt covering. I'm not convinced that it makes anybody one iota safer.
Okay.
But it seems to me to be an endless litany of forms that you have to fill out. And my very, very strong opinion is that it's not really doing what it should
be. Or it doesn't necessarily translate into practical.
Exactly. Forms don't mean safety. You can fill in any number of bloody forms, but it doesn't stop, for example, somebody not wearing their lab coat. And likewise, you can tell people 50,000 times to wear their safety glasses, and the one time that they don't will be the time that they get something in their eye.
Because that's what I was going to say. Like, there's probably a lot of blame to put on other people, but there's also still that sort of human factor where the individual could also be doing something wrong, even though they've been trained not to do it.
Yep. But then, even if that is the case, then it seems that people are still held liable for somebody else's, can I say, irresponsibility? I don't know. But, you know, people doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
So with this, I suppose, at UCLA, have they got stricter measures in place now?
Yes, and that was part of the deal with the university. So they had to ensure that they were sort of complying with all of these codes and everything like that. I mean, accidents happen.
And you can't review it super effectively, like, I suppose, that even if you were sending people to review that everything's been done the right way once in a while, there still will be occasions where you can't be there monitoring it.
Yep, exactly. And, look, I mean, you know, safety is absolutely paramount. Of course it is. And, you know, any supervisor would ensure, and, you know, everyone I know, this is what they do. They make sure that, you know, their students are going to be safe. But you can't legislate against people doing things that they're not meant to be doing. And
or making, just forgetting this one time or...
Yes, yep. And again, certainly in the States, it's very, very rare that a professor would see the inside of a chemistry laboratory. And all of the sort of the training and stuff is left to postdoctoral students usually, or doctoral students, or whatever. So, you know, the professors are too damn busy doing, you know, what they need to do. It's not necessarily the case in New Zealand, but certainly in the States, they're just, you know, they just never see the inside of a lab. So they probably wouldn't really have a clue what's going on in there. And, you know, that's certainly not ideal. It really isn't. So a really, really tragic story. And, I mean, this should sort of bring an end to it, but of course it's never going to bring an end to it for the student's family. I mean, you know, this is an utter tragedy. Hopefully some good might come out of it, but I can't really see what. I mean,
let's leave it there. moving on to the second topic, which is hangriness, or I've dubbed as hangriness.
Yes.
I believe it's a thing. I think Lisa believes it's a thing. Yeah. I know that I've experienced the thing.
Okay.
Definitely.
There is now science backing up the thing, but Alan is still unconvinced.
Well, I'm only unconvinced because I've never experienced the thing.
Okay. Oh, so you, okay. That's interesting. The only empirical, like, personal experience.
anecdotal evidence.
Bugger the scientific evidence.
Okay, let's hear the scientific evidence.
Okay, so goodness knows what made them do this, but there was some researchers at the University of Guelph, which is in Canada, and they were looking at rats, as, you know, people often do. And what they were looking at doing was to very, very rapidly drop the glucose levels in rats. So they would feed them a substance that would stop their cells uptaking glucose, okay? And surprise, surprise, they found that the rats got very lethargic and lazy when they did this, because obviously we need glucose to
have energy
to make our muscles function, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's really important. So no surprises there. However, what they then found was if they fed the rats an antidepressant at the same time as this anti-glucose stuff, then the rats wouldn't get lethargic. And
what?
Yeah. So that is really kind of weird. So what that is saying is that there's a mental effect there on the rats.
Okay? As in they were affected directly by the lack of glucose.
Exactly, by the lack of glucose. So, you know, if they had that antidepressant, then that, you know, that obviated that effect and made everything okay. So
that's
kind of weird, isn't it?
It's, I mean, I agree. Yeah. I'm sold.
So what they also found was that when the rats were all back to normal, they found that they would avoid the place where they were given the glucose blocking material. And that when they analysed their blood after all of this, they found higher levels of a stress hormone in there. So, you know, this lack of glucose was leading to stress. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, of course, they're taking the big leap and extrapolating from rats to humans and saying that this is a possible explanation for this hangry-ness phenomenon.
Okay, so there hasn't been experiments with people.
No,
that we know of.
No.
Can you test that on people?
Yeah, I'm not sure you'd want to give somebody a glucose blocking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why do we do it to rats then? I don't know.
Because we can. I mean, terrible. Oh God, the horrors that lab animals undergo on our behalves. I know it's terrible. But yeah, yeah.
Wait, so were they trying to prove that specific point in rats, or try this thing?
Well,
and see what happens.
Sometimes you do that. You just sort of say, let's try that, but. The trouble, well, not the trouble, but the difference between, let's say, my discipline and this sort of stuff is that you need ethics approval for anything to do with laboratory animals. So therefore, you need everything, every I dotted and T crossed before you actually go ahead and do these things. So
they might have had a plan.
So this experiment, yes, I'm sure it would have had to have been planned out in significant detail. And, you know, this is what we're trying to find, blah, 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 in order to get ethics approval. So
if anyone needs to look at this research and that they have it as evidence of their behaviour, where can they find it?
That's
in the news, I presume.
That's a damn good question, actually. I've forgotten where
I think
published.
I'm going to start walking around with it in my back pocket, just being like,
this is why.
I'm stressed.
Yeah, yeah, they did kind of say that if you're feeling like that, then get out a Snickers bar or something and just, you know, have a bite to eat.
That Snickers ad is a good ad. Okay, shall we? We'll do the last story, gene drives.
Yes, yes. So, it's hard to believe that I think I'm right in saying this, that 500,000 people a year still die from malaria. I think I may be overstating that, but I'm sure it's a horrendous number of people still die from malaria every year. You'd think, you know, here and now we would have sorted that out. So, what do you need to do? You need to eradicate the mosquitoes.
Yes.
Obviously, okay? Mm-hmm. So, and you can do that with DDT. You can do that brilliantly with DDT. Ask the people in Sri Lanka. DDT, dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane, or whatever. DDT, you have
DDT, we'll stick with DDT.
Okay, yes. How does it work? Carry on.
That's another story.
That is another story.
Okay,
and
stick
it's all to
the
do with
gene
Rachel
drive.
Carson and Silent Spring. And
we know that you can kill the mosquitoes. We know that.
Well, you can, but in killing them, you're also putting nasty stuff into the environment as well, which you don't want, and which is why DDT was banned.
Okay.
So this is technically a much better way of doing things. And so they're doing some genetic engineering on these mosquitoes using this CRISPR technique that probably everybody has heard about. I know.
Big fan.
And the really, really interesting thing is what they can do if they alter one gene in these malaria-carrying mosquitoes, they can wipe out a colony within 11 generations.
What?
And the way that works is that it makes the females sterile. They're targeting a part of a gene that looks that basically determines the sex of a mosquito, okay? So, and that's absolutely vital for the mosquito. So any mutations in there, in that part of the gene, are not going to be good. And so this is what they've targeted. And essentially, what happens is that the males aren't affected, and the females with one copy of the gene aren't affected, but the females with two copies of this gene then start developing both female and male characteristics. They don't bite anymore, and so therefore they can't transmit the disease. And then they start breeding, and this carries on into future generations, and eventually the whole lot die out.
So you say 11 generations. How long is 11 generations?
shit, if I knew the breeding, if I knew the gestation time of mosquito,
but it wouldn't
be very long. It might be, I don't know, a month or something. I don't know.
Yeah, so it wouldn't be very. Yeah.
So they've done this in the laboratory, and it's been obviously very, very successful. And so the next step will be sort of wild type tests out in the field. And I think they're looking at sort of a time frame, maybe 8 to 10 years before they can get this out into the wild and you know, but potentially start killing these mozzies.
So why is it called a gene drive?
Good question. It's just a terminology. Essentially, as far as I can see, somebody came up with a funky name.
Driving out this gene of the world.
It sort of drives through into future generations or something, I think. And it's not affected by, or the mosquitoes can't get resistant to this because it's affecting part of the gene that is to do with a very, very important thing like sex selection. So, yeah, that's my understanding of it anyway.
So this is a development from CRISPR.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, using CRISPR. So to really get into a certain part of the gene and alter it in particular ways. And
said 8 to 10 years until it can be done.
This is what they're looking at.
Why is
that? Again, there's probably all sorts of ethical approvals and stuff like that. And again, people have raised questions. This has been in the news. You may well have heard this over the past few days, but people have raised questions as what would happen if the mosquitoes were all killed out, then what possible follow-ons from nature?
Consequences from that.
Yeah, exactly. So are there things that feed solely on the mosquitoes, you know, next higher up in the food chain? What's going to happen to them, you know? Is it a good thing to actually try and rid the planet of mosquitoes? What's going to happen? So
would you have to, like, catch the ones that have malaria? And then
I think that what they're saying is essentially you're going to eventually kill out all mosquitoes.
Yes, because all the females will eventually become infertile.
Mm.
And so therefore they just won't be able to breed anymore.
Because you can't with this technique, you can't just wipe out the ones that carry the disease.
No.
You don't know.
And it's going to affect. And it's only the females that bite. So they're the ones that carry the disease. The males don't. So it's a potential... You know, it's a potential cure maybe for this horrendous problem. And again, other sort of Kiwis have said that it might well be useful for wasps as well.
And
I, for one, wouldn't be unhappy to see the wasp just piss off because they're nasty, nasty, horrible things. And they're not native, so we can quite happily get rid of them and there's going to be no consequences.
Right. That's just a little evil laugh.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Get a sting out of that.
But oh, no pun intended.
Oh, nice.
She's onto it.
Nice. Okay, yes, but science, right? Should science be making these moral... ends up being a moral decision. Do we, one, get rid of... Anyway, let's just not go into it.
I think we kind of do.
Yes?
I'd say so.
You get rid of the disease.
Yep.
And face the potential consequences later.
I think. What are you going to choose? A world with malaria or a world without malaria? That's your simple choice, isn't it? And everything's so lovingly black and white in science, isn't it? No, it's not. Of course it's not. But yeah.
Up for discussion.
Okay. Well, we should leave it there, I suppose.
Okay.
It's great to have you back, Alan.
It's really good to be back,
and
you guys. Yep.
We'll see you next week. I won't be here next week, but you'll get Lisa.
Yeah. Really excited.
Cool. Good chat.
Yeah, absolutely. They always are.
All right.
Cool. Okay. See ya.
That was Dear Science.